Hi friends, Talia here. I apologize for the long gap since our last episode came out. Joanna and I have been super busy fighting education and insurance battles for our kids, one of which for Joanna relates to the topic of this episode, which we recorded back in January. Join us as we talk about the sleep challenges that face many children with disabilities. We also discuss sleep studies, medication, safety beds, sleep ninjas, insurance, sleep hygiene, and so much more. Welcome to OHS, our Hidden Stories podcast. I'm Talia Emery Silva, and I'm here with my co-host, Joanna Kent. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Talia.
This podcast is a part of the Our Hidden Stories project, where our mission is to share through raw authenticity the often unseen world of special needs and disability. You can learn more at ourhiddenstories.com. And as always, please subscribe, rate us with 5 stars, and spread the word about OHS podcast. Today, Joanna and I are here to talk about sleep. Every new parent expects to have a few weeks or months of interrupted sleep before their newborn baby settles into a nap and sleep routine. There's books written about it, some promising to give you a perfect method that will enable any baby to develop good sleep habits and have everyone in the house getting a good night's rest by the time the new baby turns 6 or 9 months old or so. Now, I don't know about you all, but I found these types of generic recommendations to be kind of garbage even before I had a child with a legitimate sleep disorder. We had very different experiences with my first two kids. Neither of them have disabilities, but my oldest always struggled to sleep alone and get through the night. My middle son has always slept like a log. If I had had my middle son first, I might have thought that he was really easy because of some sleep method that I had, and it really is just that he's a good sleeper. But nothing prepared me for a child with a pretty severe sleep disorder. But even now that I do have a child with that experience, I know if I had another child with sleep challenges, those challenges might be totally different because there are many different ways that sleep disorders can manifest in our children. So Joanna and I have quite different sleep challenge stories, despite the fact that our sons share the same genetic disorder. So we thought we would take this episode to discuss some of the similarities, differences, and what we've learned along the way. So, Joanna, when was the first time you realized something was off about your son's sleep? Was it right away or not so early?
You know what was interesting? It's similar to what you were saying. My daughter never slept. She was a banshee, and she would scream out in the night. And if I got 30 minutes of sleep, it felt like a dream because she was constantly hungry. She was constantly awake and she was constantly angry. So when we found out that she had an issue with dairy, I completely changed my diet and that got us through. And she was about 2 months old at the time. And they said that there was sleep, you know, her sleep would get better and all of these things. So when I had my son, I went dairy free beforehand, being the smart mom that I was, right? And when I did that, he was such a great sleeper that here I am patting myself on the back. But he was such a great sleeper that I was concerned because he slept too much. Now, nobody mentioned hypotonia at the time, but a lot of parents of children with hypotonia will tell you their child slept a lot. I had to wake him up for every feeding. My husband's like, let him sleep, let him sleep. And here I am being like, no, no, no. My body's saying he needs to wake up and eat now. So our issues with sleep were actually different in the beginning, where he slept all the time. Out of 24 hours a day, maybe 20 hours a day he was sleeping. Felt like he fell asleep as he was eating. I'd have to wake him back up. I had to pump. If he wasn't gaining weight, I would have been nervous, but he was a dream. They call it like dream sleep. Like, what do they call that when they nurse while they
dream feeding? Yeah.
He would dream feed and we would just change his diaper and he would just feed and go back to sleep. He basically was constantly sleeping. And I even remember going to the 1 month appointment and saying, how much sleep is too much sleep? And my doctor saying, you know, after your daughter, just consider this a blessing. we had the opposite with the hypotonia. Now, what kind of sleeper was Asa as a baby?
Well, so, you know, with Asa, from day one, his sleep was the worst. On the one hand, he didn't really have any other developmental challenges until he was about a year old, but he never settled into a deep sleep. And he was easily, so easily startled that we could certainly never put him into his crib when he was not fully asleep. And then if he would fall asleep with us, it was almost impossible to pick him up and move him to his crib. He would wake up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we were able to finally get him to sleep in his crib, but then he would wake up, you know, 1 hour later. And none of that is too out of the ordinary for like the first month or maybe the second month of life, but it just never got better. It was always the same. And in fact, a lot of it got worse. And so we started having to sometimes put him to sleep on our bed with pillows all around him, because the only way to get him to sleep was for me to nurse him to sleep. And then I had to creep away from the bed, put pillows all around him. And then usually he would probably stay asleep for an hour or two until then we went to bed for the night. And then he would just sleep with us. So he slept with us most of the time for his entire first year. And we took him to see a sleep specialist at 11 months old, and everything else seemed fine with him. And so they didn't really want to pursue any more testing.
Did you do a sleep study?
Not at that time.
Okay.
Because at that time, we thought it would be very difficult to do a sleep study. And I think that the doctor at the time just said, let's just give him a little bit more time to see if he grows out of this. It was pretty difficult, but in our minds, we were still thinking, okay, you know, we're going to get through this. Eventually, it got a little bit better in the sense that we were able to transfer him to his crib, but he would still wake up a ton. We had to keep his crib in our bedroom. And by the time he was 15 months old, Asa's problems are not hypotonia very much. So he could climb out of his crib by 15 months old.
Wow. By 15 months old, Sally wasn't even standing to walk. Right.
Well, that was so frustrating, you know, because one thing was we tried a little bit to see, okay, maybe we're just being really like way too soft with him. You know, maybe we need to do the cry it out method, which we really didn't really want to do, but we had done it a little bit with my oldest son when it was time to move him to his own room. And we thought, okay, let's try it. What happened when we tried to do this with Asa was he cried for 2 hours straight.
Wow.
And this is the one and only time we tried it. He cried for 2 hours straight, finally exhausted himself, and he fell asleep. And we thought, okay, maybe we just had to be real tough with him and get him to do it. And then he woke up an hour later.
Oh, no.
So we thought, well, then there's really no point in doing this, right? Because, I mean, we're not going to put him through crying for 2 hours just to wake up an hour later. What are we supposed to do? Let him cry for another 2 hours? So it was rough. But then when we lost the ability for him to stay in his crib, because sometimes we just, you know, needed to try to see, let's see if he's going to go back to sleep. Well, once he figured out he could just climb out of the crib, everything was all over for us. We would put him to bed and he was still in the crib in our room, which is right off of the living room. We'd go outside, we might be watching TV, and then suddenly he'd bust open the door and come running out. In his sort of drunken way that he was moving at that time. And so we thought, okay, this is not safe. We dropped the mattress to the floor. We tried everything. He could still climb out of the crib. So it was getting worse and worse. We got this privacy pop tent that we put with a mattress in it in our bedroom at the foot of our bed. And so he was kind of contained in that. We weren't really comfortable putting that in his own room because it's not designed for that, but we did that to sort of create a space for him to sleep, but he was still in our room. We were still able to come to him every time he would wake up because he woke up so frequently throughout the night that for me, once I get up and I have to go upstairs or I have to move around a lot, I'm I'm not getting back to sleep. So the only way that I could get back to sleep was if he was in our room. Eventually, we went through a 2-week period where he was awake for 2 to 6 hours every single night for a week, for 2 weeks. And we thought we have to sleep to survive. And so we actually had to buckle him into his high chair and let him watch Little Baby Bum on the iPad right outside of our door. I mean, it was an absurd situation. And that was when I talked to the pediatrician and we tried to start with medication, but that's when we also got in to see the neurologist and ended up doing a sleep study and all of that. So how did your sleep study go?
We just recently got our sleep study done. So,
oh, I didn't realize it was just recently. Only.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's a good point. So we've actually had 2 sleep studies. The first time we went for a sleep study was when Sally was shy of 3. And the reason that we did was, now remember, Sally's always been a great sleeper, right? So I said he was always a great sleeper. He always slept really well. Then all of a sudden, we had a similar situation where he would wake up every single night somewhere between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. And he would be up for 2 to the rest of the night hours. At one point, he woke up screaming every night. And we thought that might have been related to night terrors. If you don't know what a night terror is, night terror is when your child wakes up screaming, but they don't wake up. So they're just screaming. They aren't awake. They're actually still asleep. You can't actually wake them up. You have to keep them asleep. So it usually happens earlier in the night. I think in most cases, it's like the first 90 minutes. I am not a sleep expert, but this is kind of what I remember from all of it. And my daughter had gone through it similarly. So when it happened with my son, I was aware. The only difference is with him, he was unreachable at that time anyway. So with my daughter, it was very obvious that something was super wrong because she wouldn't open her eyes. She wouldn't talk. She was just screaming. I thought the first time it happened, we thought she was in intense pain. With my son, because he always was unreachable, it wasn't like something we could communicate. He couldn't communicate with us. We didn't exactly know what was happening at first either with him, but we knew he never cried. So because he never cried, we figured he was either in intense pain or it was night terrors. In both cases with both my children, it happened for every couple nights for a few weeks. And then you kind of realize this is what it is. And with each child, I did a TV detox and it worked. We could talk about that another time. Anyway, with his other sleep disturbances, when we got past that, was that he was waking up and it was party time. He was jumping around. He was having fun. He was playing. But he was always safe. So unlike Asa, Sally is almost 5. He is still in his crib because he does not have the strength to pull himself out. He's also small for his age and size. We have lowered his crib as low as we can at this point because we are in the process of trying to get him an appropriate bed. Because he just runs back and forth and jumps and all that stuff, we were afraid that he might actually flip himself over the bed eventually at one point from the momentum. So, you know, because he's just like running back and forth in this crib because he has no awareness of what could possibly happen, right? In Sally's case, he wakes up. He's super excited and happy. I've talked about it previously. We do not have a way to calm down our son, especially in the earlier years. He's a little bit more responsive to us in the last few months than he's ever been. Like, you can go in there and give him a hug, and at times he actually like hugs you back. He grabs your neck and he puts his head on your shoulder for a second and you're like, oh my goodness, what's happening here? We're making a connection. It's really nice. But back when we first went to see this sleep specialist, that was not the case at all. There was nothing we could do. So we went to the sleep specialist. They agreed that we could do a sleep study, but I feel like it's really important to go through a few things about a sleep study. Number one, if you feel like you should go for a sleep study, push for the sleep study. I don't know if you felt that you had to push for a sleep study. The first time we pushed for the sleep study, And the place that we took him to was not the appropriate place. Hmm. So they were not, even though I asked the proper questions, they didn't really necessarily answer them. So the first question is, did they have the appropriate bed for my son? My son sleeps in a crib every night, right? They're like, yes, we have a crib. But their crib didn't go down low, and their crib wasn't appropriate for a 3-year-old child. So if he stood up in it, he was going to fall out.
Mm-hmm.
Second question is, did they have the appropriate staff? So they were only going to put one staff member to him, and one staff isn't going to be enough to place all those wires. There are a lot of wires. You have to move fast. We have a cognitively impaired person here who doesn't understand what you're doing. There's absolutely nothing you can say or do to calm him down. They should have had two staff members to him. The next question was, did they have protocol for what percentage of wires they actually needed and they could still run the test? So basically what ultimately happened after being there for hours the first time, they couldn't attach all the wires because at this point now he was beside himself because they would come in, attach a few, wake him up every time. And mm-hmm. they'd be like, okay, no, we're going to wait longer and we'll come back again. And then they would come back again. I'm saying they, the woman would come back again. And when she would come back, she'd wake him up every time. And she'd be like, I don't understand. He should be in a deep sleep. And I would say, that is why we are here. We are here because this child never gets in a deep sleep. Because you walked past his door and he was up and excited and happy. And I was like, I have to go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go next to my bed.
Right.
The last question I would ask is, did they have a way to keep, in my case, do you have a way to keep my son safe from all the wires? So there are a ton of wires. They do zip them up or move them away. And let me like tell you how in the second case, the sleep study actually did happen. Did they have an appropriate bed? They did. They lowered the bed to, and they understood that it had to be up against a wall in a corner and all that kind of stuff. Did they have the appropriate staff? They did. They had two people come in and attach all of the wires so it went as quickly as humanly possible. And they were trained in cognitively impaired children and adults. Did they have a protocol? They did have a protocol, but it wasn't even necessary. If a wire came off, one of the two ran in really quick and they would fix the wire and it was great. Did they have a way to keep my son safe from wires? They had multiple ways to keep him safe. A few was the tying of the wires off and kind of putting them off to the side, but giving them enough slack. The others were something called no-nos. Now, this is going to sound sad and horrible, but again, I'm going to state that my son is severely cognitively impaired to the point where he doesn't understand the words yes or no. He doesn't understand or respond to his name all of the time, and he doesn't understand anything about danger or likes. He doesn't understand he's hungry. He can't any of that. Okay, so a no-no is basically like a splint. It goes around. It keeps your limbs straight. It's soft, it has Velcro, but it is secured, and basically he was unable to bend around and move in a way that could get him tied up in the wires.
That's really cool. We did not have that in our case, I guess because Asa had always slept with us so much. In our case, I didn't even bother trying to have him in a crib because he would have climbed out of it anyway. So, what we did was in the room, it was just kind of like, it was sort of like a hotel room with a king size bed. And I just laid next to him. And so, but of course, I know that you had done the TV detox thing. So it wasn't an option for you to distract Sally with TV while they put on all the wires. But we had Asa watching Little Baby Bum or whatever it was. And I held his arms to keep him when they would keep, you know, wandering up there as they applied all of these things to his head. And then while he was sleeping, I kind of cradled his body so that it would have been hard for him to reach up to where the wires were. But of course they had pulled them up, but I didn't even know that what you just described was available. So that is really good information, because in our case, because he sleeps with me so much, and in fact, he was going to sleep better if he was next to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't think about some of those other things, but that's absolutely right. Because if you have a child who's used to sleeping in a crib by themselves, then how do you keep them from grabbing all of the wires? And I mean, and that would be an issue even for a kid who isn't as cognitively impaired, maybe as our kids are, if they're that young and they're having a sleep problem. So that is such good information.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest things for us is that Sally is not a cuddler. He will not fall asleep cuddling. Like I could never do that. It's actually one of the saddest parts of when he was a baby for me, was that when he would get upset in the night or something, I could never calm him. And looking back now, I feel a little bit of relief about that. But at the time when he was little, it would be so defeating for me that a lot of times I would just be like, can you go in to my husband? And honestly, it made me feel bad because he could do it, but I couldn't. And the thing that he did, and all he would say is, I just hold him snug. Like he would apply pressure. Like realizing now that my son is so sensory and that he needs like added pressure, and that like that excites him and makes him happy and things like that. I realized I was just like trying to be calm and soothing and like light touch and
like
all
that. Too gentle. Yeah.
Yeah. It was never going to work. But at the time I just felt like a failure as a mom because I felt like I tried everything I could. I would be in there for like an hour just trying to get him to go back to sleep, and I couldn't do it. And also, we didn't realize that there was a little light on in his head that we couldn't shut off.
Exactly.
At 2 o'clock in the morning when we were exhausted. But as time went on for us, we didn't have results after the first test, and I didn't want to do the second test, but we did do it and we got some results. Now, did you get some results from yours?
We did. They were not particularly helpful. it showed that he had what's called mild obstructive apnea. Apparently, you can also have central sleep apnea where, for whatever reason, the person is – apnea is meaning that you're stopping breathing from time to time while you're sleeping, and then that can wake you up because your body this is my understanding. We should always give the disclaimer, this is not medical advice. but it can happen that your body wakes up a little bit, because of course you want your body to wake up when you stop breathing. So I believe that central sleep apnea is more not because of obstruction with your sinuses or something, but just because for some reason your body is doing that. That didn't really seem to be what Asa's problem was. He had some mild obstructive apnea from his tonsils. This was before we had a genetic diagnosis, and all of it didn't really explain the problem. Mm-hmm. We had a judgment call to make because his tonsils were quite enlarged. We thought, well, this will possibly help with his sleep. And from what we understood, the recovery from a tonsillectomy and also his adenoids that ended up coming out too, and an adenoidectomy, is harder the older you are. So we thought, well, if it's already such a problem now when he is 2 years old, let's just go ahead and get it over with and get these out. And hopefully maybe it'll also help with his sleep.
Yeah, let's get some sleep.
Yes. Well, it did make a difference with his colds. He had kind of an ongoing runny nose situation, and that cleared up a lot when we got the tonsils and adenoids out. But unfortunately, it made zero difference for his sleep. That was very disappointing. However, right around the same time, we finally got our genetic results back, and we found out that Asa had Phelan-McDermid syndrome. Oh, and I should say, there was still in the sleep study lots and lots of disturbances. He woke up way more often for these little, you know, little tiny wake ups all throughout the night than the average. And the thing is, we did the sleep study while he was already taking a sleep medication. So he was able to actually sleep. I do not think we could have even done the sleep study had he not already been taking something for his sleep. And I asked them, is it okay to give him his sleep medicine while we're doing the sleep study? And they said, yes, because we're still going to see what's going on in his brain. So it definitely showed that there were problems, but the tonsillectomy did not really make a difference. Then we got the genetic results and it made a lot of sense suddenly what our problem was, because the gene that is impacted, which is called SHANK3, as you know, it plays a role in modulating sleep and establishing circadian rhythm. And while not, you know, as your son's situation and mine show, it doesn't impact everybody the same way, even if you have a problem with that gene. But if you are having a bunch of major sleep problems and you have a problem with that gene, chances are that's what's going on. And so that made us feel a lot better about the fact that we were giving him medication. Because we had felt kind of bad. Like by the time that we resorted to trying a prescription medication for his sleep, we had already tried melatonin. We had tried white noise. We had tried making it very dark in the room. We had tried, you know, we're letting him sleep with us in the bed. I mean, we were doing everything that we could and we were feeling really desperate. But then we felt guilt no more after we got the genetic result, because we thought, okay, well, that's why he's not sleeping. And if this medication is enabling him to sleep, whatever, at that point, we thought, whatever possible side effects for him don't seem to be significant for this medication. And on the other hand, there were some pretty significant side effects from him not sleeping. He actually made some developmental gains when he started sleeping better. Not super significant, but he did make some gains. So, and I would just add one other thing, and then I wanted to hear the rest of your story. When we finally were able to get an enclosed bed that is designed for special needs children, where we would feel that he would be safe if he wakes up in the middle of the night, there's no way he can get out of it, that has made a big difference. Because what we actually didn't realize was that in the process of keeping him in our room in order to be there whenever he woke up, which was inevitably a lot.
Yeah.
We were waking him up though, because, you know, we would put him to bed at 8 o'clock or something. And then we would come in, and even though, I mean, we became these ninjas.
Totally.
We would come into the room, and I had this whole thing where I would roll across the bed to get to my side, because I didn't want to take the chance of walking around and accidentally hitting the tent that he was sleeping in. And
of course.
So I would, you know, roll all the way across. And then we would, if we wanted to read our phones before we went to sleep, we would put it under the covers so that the light would not, we would do all of these things. But what we've discovered is now that he's in his own room in this enclosed bed, he does sleep better, because even though we were trying our very, very best and we thought we were amazing at it, you wake up and you move around, or maybe we snored or something. And it was like this bad cycle, right? Where he's prone to waking up. And so then when we hear him, we move, and then he hears us move, and then he wakes up more. And so anyway, it's actually a lot better now. But you tell me how you ended up, once you did have your sleep study, what did it tell you? And then what decisions have you made?
Every doctor has always said, it's always great to get a baseline, even if you don't get a result that you were hoping for from the test, right? So In our case, it was very similar to yours. He was at the high end for a lot of things. This was my biggest worry. I'm going to be honest with you. I was afraid they were going to say, your son has sleep apnea. Medical sleep apnea. And I was going to say, what do you want me to do about that? Now I can't sleep at night. I can't put a mask on this child.
Right. He's not going to tolerate like an oxygen mask or something.
Exactly.
Right?
So I said no to the test because I didn't want them to tell me that result. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end, they did tell me that, because they were worried that with the hypotonia, like you were saying, sometimes everything's a muscle, right? So that the muscles relax too much in the neck and that maybe he would stop breathing. Mm-hmm. But they said that that is why he's a light sleeper, because he's waking himself up. Like you said, they wake themselves up because they can't breathe. Does wake himself up a lot, but not too much. I guess he's just at the higher end of everything, but he's not too much of anything. So he moves his legs too much. He moves his he just moves a lot. He wakes himself up a lot. Everything was like at the higher end, but not dangerous enough. And I was like, okay, great. So what is this? This is our baseline.
What do we do now?
This is our baseline. We do not do medication. He actually still is amazing at going to bed at night. When he wakes up at 2 o'clock in the morning and has a party, if he's not screaming because he's upset, we let him have his party. We can hear him because he's so loud. And he has his own room. We know he's safe. But the test also helped us because he needs an appropriate bed. He needs a bed where we can monitor him properly because he is unable to communicate in any way. And he needs a bed that can keep him safe because it's not appropriate to keep him in a crib for much longer. He's going to be too big soon. Luckily for us, we're working with Stanford Children's Hospital and they're helping us to try to secure a bed. You bought a bed yourself or you went through insurance?
We attempted to go through insurance, but our insurance would not cover an enclosed bed for him because they had some sort of screwy requirement that they would only provide an enclosed bed if he needed a hospital bed.
Yes. Okay.
Which was something that we couldn't establish.
Well, no, you can't because hospital beds aren't enclosed. It's good that you're mentioning this because this is kind of the situation we're in right now. Most people who need hospital grade beds need beds because their children are unable to move.
Move, right.
Or the way that they move is not this, it's not cognitively impaired in this same way necessarily that our children are. Mm-hmm. So our children are dangerously mobile where they can run around and they can climb and they can get on things, but they don't understand the concept of how to get down safely.
Right. Or in Asa's case, you know, well, we want it to be very dark in his room, but then if he wakes up, he's going to run around and he could hurt himself because it's going to be pitch black in his room.
Yeah, exactly. Same thing for Sally. Sally's room is pitch black. There's no nightlight. There's no...
Right. In order to help them sleep. But then, yeah, if they were to get up, then they could, and the things we couldn't even put a nightlight, even if the light were okay, we couldn't put a nightlight.
No, it's not
because
safe.
It would not be safe. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not safe. And it's a very complicated situation that we're in as parents, because what I said when I was told this was going to be a fight, I said, what are they saying that my child should do? Are they saying my child should just sleep on the floor? And I'm not even saying a mattress on the floor, because I can't put just a mattress on the floor, because he can step up and off the mattress, or he could fall out of the bed, or he could step the wrong way. And because of his hypotonia, the way his ankles are turned, a mattress is too high. He can't go up and off a mattress. So it's not safe for him to just be in a wide open space. So I'd have to take everything out of his room, because it could only be a room. And the chances are, what if he falls asleep behind the door? Because he doesn't understand the concept of, I have to stay in the bed.
Right.
There are a lot of dangerous things that most people don't think about or talk about because they don't have to.
Right.
So,
And the frustrating thing, at least with our insurance, is that they're basically taking the position, well, we're not going to cover something which is designed to prevent an injury. They're like, there isn't already an injury. So they're like, if you need a hospital bed, then you already have some sort of condition that is requiring you to be in a safe hospital bed. But of course, like we were discussing, if you need to be in a hospital bed, you probably couldn't move in the ways that our kids can move in the first place. I guess they can get away with it because they're saying, well, they're basically making the assertion it's not medically necessary for us to help you to prevent your child from being injured.
That's so interesting, because I know that a lot of people, the way they get their insurance appeals approved is by proving that it can prevent further, more serious damage.
Well, in our case, the clinical policy bulletin specifically says they won't cover anything that prevents injury.
But that sounds... Wow. I mean,
because they don't consider it medically well, you know about my insurance though, right? Like they don't consider it medically necessary to prevent Asa from getting run over by traffic. They don't consider it medically necessary for him to, you know, not escape out of a chair and go pull a pot of boiling water over his head. It's a really big challenge. What we ended up doing to get ours was the brand that we went with is a company that offers a 50% discount if you have an insurance denial, especially if you're able to also provide proof of your child has a significant diagnosis.
Yeah.
And so we got this 50% discount. And then there's a nonprofit that also helped us with it some, because we should mention that to get these in special needs enclosed beds, they are thousands of dollars.
Yeah, that's where we are right now. And that's just the protection part, not even the mattress or any of that.
Right, right.
I struggle with this a lot because when the hospital, the person who's trying to help me get the bed said, this probably isn't going to get approved because it's, you know, it's not a medical grade bed or the way that she said it. And I said, so what kind of dignity does my son deserve?
Exactly.
And she's like, no, I agree with you. I said, okay, well then we have a fight ahead of us. I'm very fortunate being in California and the company that, you know, we have our insurance through, we actually have a third party that helps us with insurance issues. So I don't even have to call the insurance company. I call the third party and they help me with appeals, with any discrepancies when I do out of network. And so far they've been amazing.
That's great.
Yes, we are lucky. And I'm also very fortunate that the state of California is very thoughtful of cognitively impaired people. Not every state does that. Mm-hmm. I did have some struggles in Illinois. We didn't always qualify for things because being cognitively impaired sometimes isn't enough.
Right.
Having hypotonia was, but being cognitively impaired wasn't. And it's
even though it's the cognitive impairment and in a lot of ways that is making the hypotonia much more dangerous.
Oh, I mean, that's why he has hypotonia. I mean,
right.
It's a cognitive disorder, really. So,
but you know, a child that understands danger, even if they have hypotonia, it isn't as dangerous because maybe you could explain to the child, like, you need to wait in bed for mom or dad to help you out or something like that, or intellectual disability, whatever you want to call it, is such a major factor in safety. And it is ridiculous that it's basically not taken into account in some places in some contexts.
It does. It feels like a fight. Let's wrap this up by talking a little bit about maybe sleep hygiene.
Sleep hygiene is the idea that you need to create the best possible environment for sleep. And for a lot of children, babies, toddlers, that is actually enough to really make a big difference in their sleep quality. So the recommendations that I would make is, you know, white noise machine has been amazing.
Yes.
Because, you know, you have the, and we've actually gotten used to having a white noise machine going in our room since we had Asa sleeping with us for years. And so we use one at night too. And it helps me with sleep, but it really means that the other people in the family don't have to tiptoe around outside because it might possibly wake up the person who has the sleep challenges. And that doesn't mean that we like them right outside of his door yelling and screaming, but it, when we started using a really powerful white noise machine, that did make a big difference. Blackout shades, if you can use them, have been really good as well, because especially in the summertime, bedtime might be when it still is pretty bright outside. And in the morning, at least Asa, if it is bright and sunny, he is going to be, I'm awake. So especially in the middle of the summer, you know, if it's getting bright really early, having a blackout shade will help to give us a little bit of extra time in the morning. I definitely recommend the kind that you just pull that does not have a cord. You can get the cordless ones. So those two things, in addition to some of the supplements and medications we use for Asa, do make a big difference. They are important contributing factors to helping him get a good night's sleep. They just for Asa are not enough, but for a lot of people, they will be. And I know that you have some thoughts on also keeping a regular bedtime or figuring out a good sleep schedule.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it was really important that our son went to sleep on his own. Think self-soothing, right? So we don't want him to have to need a specific person or thing. We realize that he is a cyclical sleeper. So we know that he has periods of great sleep and periods where he doesn't have great sleep. We're very thoughtful of that. And we try not to disrupt him. So if he does wake up and he sounds fine, we don't bother him. I know that sounds really weird to not go in and check on your child. We do a sniff test just to make sure he didn't poop because—
Oh my gosh, we do those too.
Because a lot of us know that we don't want him to, that to be the reason why he woke up and he's not going to tell us. So we do that. But other than that, we do not go in and cause any disruption. We want him to understand that it's nighttime and to continue sleeping. We also think that it's important to find when bedtime really is. So
yes,
my husband disagreed on when bedtime was in the beginning, because he would come home and I'd be like, he's asleep. And he'd be like, why did you put him up already? And I say, he was showing me the signs. I went with him. If he showed me the signs, he went to bed. Mm-hmm. So when we cut out naps, his bedtime changed by almost over 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So sometimes he went to bed at 5 o'clock. Sometimes he went to bed at 5:30 and he never got to see his dad, but it was temporary. And I knew that. And so that was kind of the way that I looked at it. I know a lot of people, they want to spend time in the evening with their children and they push the child. And when you push your child, they push through. And when they push through, it gets harder and harder each time to go to sleep. So the minute I see it's a sign, it's bedtime. Now we're on a routine and bedtime is the exact same time every night because he knows, like his body starts to know and be aware. So I think it's really important to first follow their cues, then create. I know a lot of people have always said that they like their child to fit in their schedule, like their families to fit in their schedule, and they want to spend that quality time. But I try to say all the time, like, this is temporary. Your child is going to be up till midnight. When they get older, it's adjustable.
Yeah, we're one of those families where with my older two, we've never been super strict about bedtime. I mean, it's not like we let them stay up to all hours, but we haven't been like, okay, it's 8 o'clock, time to go to bed.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I know some people are very regimented when their children, especially when their children are very young. But what we have discovered with Asa also is that he does a lot better if we don't push him. And so for us to do like a 6 or 6:30 bedtime felt super, super early, but that's kind of what we've settled into. It's rare that he is going to bed after 7. But the thing is, he doesn't fall asleep on his own very well, usually. If he does, he might be sick. but what I try to do is to read the signs, and definitely when he starts to act like he's tired, then we give him his sleep medication.
Yeah.
Because we know that then within 30 minutes to an hour, it will enable him to fall asleep. We're not trying to knock him out. It's more like his body is telling him that he's tired, but we know that if we leave it up to him, it would probably take him 4 or 5 hours to get to sleep, and it'll probably just get worse and worse, and he'll be very whiny and everything. And so I just brought that up because it is possible to still be reading your child's signals, even if you're using medication. It's not like the medication is a substitute for finding your child's natural natural sleep rhythm, I guess.
Again, we don't use medication, but I don't use it because we don't need to at this point.
Right. I hope you continue not to.
So do we. But we're not opposed to medication. We just know that it's not what we need right now. If I wasn't getting sleep consistently, I probably would think differently. But the other day I was up for the day, 4:30 in the morning. It was just, Yikes. You know, well, sometimes you're like, he's you know the difference. You get used to it. Like, you know he's not going back to sleep, mm-hmm. or you know you have a chance of getting him back to sleep. It was one of those days that I was like, he's not going back to sleep. So I just got up, and I'm hoping that we'll get back to where we're supposed to be. And that's just what it is. But other families, you know, you've shown us that it's okay to do the sleep medication. It's not always a perfect fit at first. It does take a little fine tuning.
Yes.
But sleep is really important. And like you said, it was able to help Asa function properly. It's able to help you as a parent not be so tired. And I know for me, when
yes.
my fuse does get a little short after a couple of days of not getting enough sleep.
For sure.
But my husband's really good at waking up early usually.
Yeah, mine too.
I'm not going to even sugarcoat that one. He is usually the first one to run into Sally's room in the morning, which is always really sweet. Well, thank you so much for sharing so much about this, because it is a really – sleep is never overrated.
Yes. And before you have kids, you have no idea what the luxury you're living in. Whenever you're sleeping. Well, thank you for your thoughts on this too. I hope for our listeners that it's been a good discussion, because we have had quite different experiences with sleep, even with two kids who have the same genetic disorder. And so I'm sure that when you factor in all of the various types of conditions that different people might have, that there could be sleep issues that you and I like haven't even imagined yet. If any of you listeners would like to share any of your challenges with sleep with your child or for yourself, and maybe what things you would recommend, what things have worked for you, we would absolutely love to hear from you. The link to the URL for this podcast episode will be in the show notes. And we really hope that this discussion has been helpful, especially for anyone listening who is at the beginning of a journey with a child who has some significant sleep challenges. Thanks again for listening to OHS Podcast. Mm-hmm.